We're going to plunge right into this. Governor Daniel Malloy, the 88th governor of Connecticut, is in here. He's governor for just a few more days, and he's been courteous enough to take some time, talk a little bit to me, as he has to other members of the media, about his time in office. So first of all, how are you feeling right now? I mean, does it feel hard to let go, or are you sensing a burst of enthusiasm for your upcoming freedom? I mean, where's your mood?
It's not hard. Well, there are hard parts. I got to, you know, pack everything in the office and pack everything at the house and get out in time. But I'm absolutely ready to live a different life.
And when you say that, is it because just the way that you chose to govern? You're a workaholic. We've talked about this in the past. The job just never goes away for you. I mean, it's not a job that you really have luxuriated in very much, I don't think.
No, you know what? It's a combination of things. I mean, I do love to work, and I do love to prepare to make decisions, and I love making decisions. That's you know, who I am and what I am. In part, there's other parts of who I am. You know, I'm happily married. My wife and I met on April 6, 1974. We got married on September 25th of 1982, and she's my best friend. So we have that. And I have three sons, two of whom are married, and we have a grandchild. There's lots of ways to spend time doing other things. And I think also what people probably don't have in the equation is I spent 14 years as the chief executive officer of a fairly major city. So, you know, the combined 14 years there, 1 year running for this office and 8 years in this office, it's been a more than enough work for a lifetime.
Yeah. Although, I mean, I do think that that's your disposition very much. And, you know, it's interesting, during this past campaign, I said a few times, particularly as the Republican candidate just talked about one thing over and over, I kept saying, you know, Johanna Hayes can go to Congress and work probably mainly on one thing in her first term as a member of Congress. And the rest of the time, you know, an awful lot of her thinking and activities will be governed a little bit by leadership. When you're governor, and you know this better than anybody, you don't even know what's going to be on your desk on any given day. But it's not going to be one thing, right? It's 8, 9, 10 things.
Yeah, I hope so. I hope that's the challenge that the next governor has. It's the way it should be. Listen, I could have had a much smaller scope of work that I wanted to accomplish. I just would have been bored and unhappy with myself if I had eliminated issues that needed to be taken on. So I took them on. And, you know, I've told this story time and time again in the last few weeks. I mean, I never thought I'd have a second term. So I worked as hard as I could and raised as many issues as I could in the first 4 years. And lo and behold, I ended up getting reelected. And so I went back to the game book and said, let's take on as many issues as we can this 4 years. And that's what we did.
So when you say you never expected to have a second term, that's a mindset. I think Ned Lamont has expressed a similar mindset during this campaign, that ultimately that frees you up to do what you have to do. You're not here to make friends. You're here to make decisions. You were able to do that or be in that frame of mind and still run again anyway.
Well, I didn't pull any punches the first 4 years, and I didn't pull any punches the last 4 years. This adage that my mother burned into my mind, that you have an obligation to leave the world a better place for you having lived in it, needed to be fulfilled to the highest extent possible, and that's what I did.
One of my theories about this past election was that the campaigns were conducted as though a reform governor was needed, that someone needed to come in and do reforms. My theory has been you were a reform governor. Somehow or other, that message has not always gotten out. I mean, when we review everything that you did, all the changes you make, it's hard not to call you one of the most radical reform governors in Connecticut history. Somehow or other, that hasn't attached itself to you the way it should have.
That may be true. One of the things that I came to understand is I didn't have control over that issue, how these things would be perceived. And so I had to make sure that my perception for me was the correct one and let the rest of it be damned.
So, you know, when I think of Ella Grasso, I probably think about Storm Larry, and I think about probably the FOI loss and stuff like that. You think about Governor Weicker, you think about obviously the state income tax, you think about Governor Rowland. Well, we know how that turned out. How do you want people to think about you? If people are going to think about one, two, three things about you, what do you want them to be?
First, the thing I'm proudest of is that we put together an unbelievable team who stayed around over half of it into the eighth year. And there were no silos left. You know, we took a multi-dimensional, multi-department approach to all of the big issues that we took on. So there was never one commissioner quarterbacking at anything. This was a group of equals that worked together to bring about unbelievable change. And so you can talk about corrections reform or criminal justice reform or education reform or health reform or housing reform or transportation reform. And every one of those issues was represented not by a single commissioner, but multiple commissioners who were pulling in the same direction. So that, you know, that's what I, you know, that's what I'm proudest about. And then all of those subsets of issues that we took on to an unbelievable extent. And I wouldn't leave out having really tamed the state's state employee pension problem. And having been honest about that and told the truth about it for the first time in Connecticut history. I think that a lot of what we did around that issue has been purposely misconstrued by folks who wanted to run on the belief that we hadn't done what we did. But in the first CBAC agreement of my administration, the second agreement of my administration, we really don't have a state pension plan problem to the extent that it existed when I became a governor. In fact, the Pew Charitable Trust, you know, did a stress test on our state pension and said we fly, you know, we passed with flying colors, that the things that we did and undertook to do have put the state in a much better situation. We made some limited progress on the teachers. I'm unhappy that we weren't able to straighten out the state teacher pension problem, but I have no doubt that that's going to be undertaken and accomplished in part because we raised the issue.
Yeah. I mean, I do feel that there are a million of these things, not a million, there are a lot of these things that are still missing from the public consciousness. For example, I think you are the first governor since the system existed to make the required yearly payment into the pension fund.
Year after year after year after painful year. Yes.
Yeah. And I mean, that obviously one of the reasons that there was a crisis is that that hadn't been done before. And then the other thing.
But there was something to that. Yeah. I couldn't have the discussions that I needed to have and the pushing and cajoling the legislature to do the right thing if I myself was not doing the right thing. If I was not doing that, we could not have succeeded. And it's not just the legislature. If I was not doing that, we could not have succeeded with labor. Mm-hmm. You know, I had to bear the scars of doing it, and it was painful, but the final product produced was well worth it.
The other way that I understand this, and correct me if I'm wrong, I know that you will correct me if I'm wrong, is imagine that Ned Lamont did nothing about pensions for the next 4 years. Still, what's going to happen now is that people holding the tier one pensions, the most lavish pensions people picture when they worry about or get outraged about state worker pensions, those people are going to gradually die off and die out of the system. And the people coming in to replace them are on a much different plan, not exactly defined contribution, but much, much closer to that.
So it's a hybrid. Yeah. It's absolutely a hybrid. But what people don't understand about that system is that if we don't meet our investment goals, their contributions automatically go up. And we have much more conservative, I would admit, investment goals, which really are meant to reflect what's possible. But if they're not met, the onus is on the employee to contribute a larger amount of their salary. And that's built into that system.
And there's another thing that I'm still not fully understanding here, but I've tried to understand over the last few days. It appears that in 21 and 22, the years 21 and 22, there are these trigger points, these cost of living trigger points, where it's anticipated that a lot of state workers will leave of their own volition. Can you explain that?
Sure. If you work beyond that and you're in a class that has a superior level of benefits, if you work beyond a certain date, then your benefit package will change. And it is our firm belief, backed up by independent analysis, that between the date of the third CBAC agreement and 2022, that roughly 16,000 state employees will leave the employee of the state to be replaced by Tier 4 employees which is largely a self-funded, a slight contribution by the state and primarily funded by the employee themselves, albeit they'll know what they'll receive, but they don't know necessarily on day one what they'll be contributing because it will be tied to the return on investment. So just put it in perspective. We average about 1,300 to 1,500 employee turnover per year. Mm. We reached that agreement 18 months ago. The idea that in 18, 19, 20, 21, and 22, you're actually going to see 16,000 people leave, an average of, 4,000 a year, is quite extraordinary and puts that plan in a very different situation going forward with respect to the people who will have become employed after 2011 or after 2015.
And that's also a little bit of a source of concern, I would think, too. You've already downsized state government. What, about 3,500 fewer positions?
About 3,700. Yeah.
So you've already downsized state government.
That's never happened before.
Yeah. No, you are the workforce grew under other governors. You have shrunk the workforce. But, there's a certain point at which there are services that are valuable that need to be delivered by the state government. The example that I always give, just because it's something that people kind of perk up about, is consumer protection goes and inspects gas pumps and makes sure that, that if you're pumping 12 gallons of gas, if it says that on the meter, that's actually what it gets pumped. But you got to have somebody to do that. Ideally, you want to have enough inspectors so that they can do random checks as opposed to respond to a call for distress. I mean, I could give, or you could give 50 other examples of things that people do in state government that are important that I, the consumer, the citizen, the voter, would benefit from. So you don't want the workforce to get so small.
I'm not saying that any governor over the next 4, 5, 6 years could tolerate an additional 14,000 or 16,000 fewer jobs in the state workforce. I'm not saying that at all, but the replacement workforce. Let's assume
they're going to be cheaper.
That someone goes from we've reduced the size of executive branch by about over which the executive branch has control by 13%. Let's assume that goes to 15 to 20%. The rest of those jobs still have to be filled. That's thousands of additional new state employees coming to the state, but they're coming to the state with a very different set of expectations with respect to their benefits when and if they retire. And therein is a great opportunity. Now, we were able to cut the size of government. And by the way, Connecticut as a state has the leanest number of employees, public employees per 100,000 of any state in the nation. And we dropped it substantially while I was governor. You can't do that forever. The reason we could do it is we invested in things that no one else would invest in. Technology, modern technology. When I became governor, the technology the state government was using to run itself was probably 8 to 10 years behind the place I had left, the city of Stamford. Mm-hmm. And we were brave enough to make the technological investments, tens of millions of dollars, on a yearly basis, to give people the tools necessary to make them more efficient so that we could consolidate government and make it smaller.
So just to review, you made government smaller. You transitioned newer employees onto a different kind of a pension plan. You replenished the rainy day fund, which was at zero, I believe, when you came in. You paid off the loans that the REL administration and legislature had to, the money that they had to borrow in order to sort of essentially balance the budget before you came in. You reduced the deficit as a portion, a percentage of the budget. And yet, this last campaign was all about, like, Dan Malloy, the guy who didn't fix anything. Somebody's got to come in and fix everything because Dan Malloy didn't do anything. I mean, that's got to drive you crazy.
Well, he left one thing out. Yeah,
okay. Population at a 25-year low.
I don't know. Pick whatever
you want.
I didn't borrow the $1 billion that Jody Rell and the legislature had negotiated for the next governor to borrow, which was painful. And it was one of the reasons that the tax increase was as large as it was, because I wasn't going to borrow that money because the economy was not going to improve fast enough in Connecticut to justify that kind of expenditure. So, it's frustrating a lot. You know, there are a number of factors that go into that, and not the least of which is that people lie about it. Mm-hmm. You know, that if you, for instance, and I've used this as an example, every candidate who ran in the last election, primaries or final election, at some point said Connecticut was bleeding jobs. Well, mm-hmm. I'm going to leave office with the state having over 100,000 more jobs, well over 100,000 more jobs since I became governor. That's the reality. And so let's put that in perspective. Jody Rell lost jobs, 36,000. John Rowland in the space of 10 years saw the creation of 63,000 jobs. Lowell Weicker lost jobs. In 8 years, we've seen the creation of over 1,000 jobs and a decrease in all forms of government employment, which I would argue, by the way, is not a bad thing. And most people say they want smaller and more efficient government. So that's not what people who don't like what I was doing would say. That people didn't understand what actually was happening. And, you know, I'm sure I bear a part of the responsibility for that, although I certainly tried to explain it to people. But, you know, we had people in the legislature vote against things that they never read.
Mm-hmm. Is part of the problem also. Did you see Hamilton while I was here?
No.
You should have seen Hamilton. All right. So one of the songs, one of the refrains in Hamilton has to do with George Washington saying, you can't control who lives, who dies, who tells your story.
Right. You know, if you're I'm familiar with, yeah. with
so,
the piece.
So, so if you're the only person telling your story and if you're the only person around counteracting lies that are told or distortions or misstatements, that's a big burden for one person to bear. Is part of the problem you didn't have enough allies who would also tell that story, get that message out?
Well, I think there's a few things that contribute to what's going on in the country right now, and that's quite frankly the decline in the number of people who report things. Mm-hmm. You know, if you look at the newsroom of any newspaper in Connecticut, it is substantially smaller today than when I was elected. And a lot of that happened in the first 4 years that I was elected. There just weren't enough people who cared to tell the truth about what was going on because there were just fewer people. Mm-hmm. That's number one. Number two, our sense of reporting has changed dramatically. When I first got in politics and including most of the time that I was mayor of Stamford, no reporter would have reported something I said unless they verified it was true.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That doesn't exist anymore in American journalism, and there's lots of reasons. I'm not blaming anybody. There's mm-hmm. lots of reasons for it, including the internet and different ways people garner information. But the role of the press in American history was to be the truth tellers, and that's changed. It's to tell the story as anyone perceives it and let the public decide. Well, the public doesn't like to do hard things, they'd rather reject doing hard things than embrace doing hard things.
We're going to take a little break. We're talking to the 80th governor of Connecticut, Governor Daniel Lalay. We'll take a quick break, and we'll come back. We're back with Governor Daniel Malloy. He has just a few days left in office. There's another inauguration coming in soon. By the way, I'm lucky enough to have Lydia Brown, Brush with Greatness, running the board today. There's going to be another inauguration coming up. I think we have a clip from the inauguration in 2011. Let's hear how that sounded.
As most people in Connecticut know, ours is not a pretty picture. Today, I see an economic crisis, an employment crisis, both fueled by unfriendly employer environment, a lack of educational resources, a deteriorating transportation system, and an enormous budget crisis of historic proportions, all coddled by a habit of political sugarcoating that has passed our problems on to the next generation. Well, ladies and gentlemen, the next generation is here.
How's that guy sound to you?
It's me.
Yeah.
That's me.
What would you say to that guy?
Get the job done.
Yeah.
Don't stop until your last day in office. And hopefully you'll make the kind of progress that we've made.
There, I want to talk in this section about two things that that guy could not have known were coming. One of them was Sandy Hook, and the other one was Sandy. So let's talk about Sandy Hook first. My sense is that Sandy Hook changed you, and changed you in a fairly profound way. Maybe talk a little bit about the day or your memory or how you think it did affect you.
It's a day the likes of which you can't prepare for, although I think because I had been mayor of Stamford and had experienced a lot of deaths on 9/11 in my community, I was perhaps better prepared than other people might have been. You know, we got originally a message that there'd been a shooting at a school and there was one fatality or one injury. Well, you know, as a former prosecutor, you know, that sounds like a domestic. You know, I think for the first 45 minutes, that was the expectation, is that we were dealing with a domestic situation where someone had gone to the school and purposely killed, you know, a loved one or someone that they were attached to. Obviously, then things started to roll in much more rapidly. I got in the car and got down there. A couple of things stick out. I asked where the select woman was. Because it appeared to me that no one was in charge, not passing judgment on anybody, but, you know, we have a lot of state police and we have a lot of local police officers. And so I had a conversation with the first selectman. I said, listen, I'm a former mayor. You're the select woman. If you want to be in charge, that's okay. We do have a lot of state troopers here. We got a bigger force. If you want us to take charge, I'll do that. Tell me what you want me to do. I remember that outside the firehouse, and we came to an agreement that the state should play the lead role. And probably within an hour and a half or 2 hours, I realized that, you know, that there were a great many fatalities, and I began the discussion with the law enforcement personnel about when we would inform the families of what had happened, the families that were remaining in the firehouse, because everyone else had come and reclaimed their children or a loved one. I've told this story before. The protocol for that kind of information exchange under normal circumstances would require an identification of the deceased before you would tell a loved one that their loved one had passed. And I actually regret that I lived with that protocol for an hour or maybe even 2 hours after that, because it all kind of melds together. And by this time, we were having regular meetings with everyone and answering questions and talking about what we're doing, meaning the people in the firehouse. And the last time I asked about when we were going to tell everyone, you know, I asked the question, well, when do you think that's going to happen? And they, you know, based on calculations, they had already figured out that, you know, that would be late at night or the next day, and here we had this intolerable situation for these families. And I made the decision. I did one other thing, because I didn't want to do it in mass. I walked from the firehouse to a office building that was within a couple of 150 yards, thinking that maybe we could move people there, a family at a time, and have a private conversation. And I was immediately set upon with, you know, the press trying to get the information that they wanted to get and report and should get and report. And I realized that the only way to do it was in mass, and I did it. I regret having waited for that time to pass. I regret that I didn't immediately overrule the protocol. We did another really astounding thing. We assigned each family a police officer or a trooper that would be with them through at least through the funerals that we knew that they would be experiencing. And, you know, that's now become, in these mass casualty situations, a best practice that really I created on you know, there. I wanted, rather than having a different police officer talk to every family member that was there getting information, I wanted them each to know that they had someone that they could rely on, someone that would be communicating with them and would protect them and their family ultimately after we had told them what had happened. So it was, and then, you know, all the funerals and memorial services and all of those other issues were part of that December. And then it was a less joyous, I suppose, Christmas than we would normally have experienced. And certainly, you know, any impact that I or anybody who survived had in their lives, it pales in comparison to the lives that were lost, the lives that were changed by those losses. And quite frankly, even folks who were in the school and didn't die that day have been profoundly impacted. So it's small in comparison.
Well, you say that. First of all, I'm going to tell you something. There's no way you didn't have PTSD from this. I mean, there's just no way. Given where you were, what your responsibilities were, the things you saw, the people you were in touch with, the magnitude of this, there's no way you don't have or didn't have PTSD. And do you understand it's okay that it really hurt you?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Sure, sure. I understood that then. It doesn't, you know, but again, I can't, you know, this is not a woe is me.
No, but it's okay, and it's not a woe is me. But I think sometimes first of all, I think you've grown up your entire life with this whole idea that you have to harden yourself off against challenges. You have to toughen up. You have to get yourself ready to take on something. I don't think you really do give yourself a lot of permission to admit how vulnerable you, like any other person, are. And does that seem, I feel like I should be getting a copay here under the state health plan, but you know what I'm saying to you?
Sure, I know what you're saying to me. I understand perfectly well. You know, I've said before that I absolutely went into a depression as mayor after 9/11 and experiencing what I experienced there, and that paled in comparison to what I had to handle, I shouldn't say it that way. What I had to help other people handle on that day and the days that followed. You know, and that's also why. You know, when I witnessed the failure of the legislature to, quote unquote, produce a bipartisan gun legislation, because the pledge had been made by the speaker that this would be done on a bipartisan basis, but the first votes were unsuccessful, that I threw myself into that. And I was more than happy, I suppose, to go on the road and take the abuse from gun owners and manufacturers for I don't know, I think up to 17 different times, because, you know, it was a way, I'm sure, to deal with what I might have been going through. But I also wanted to accomplish meaningful gun control legislation, and we did it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, motivations to do any good thing are probably good motivations, and we accomplished that.
Yeah. It's a very workaholic way of dealing with your vulnerabilities. Maybe in retirement you take a little bit of time to do the other part of it.
Yeah, maybe.
So let's talk about the other Sandy. Sandy, the storm, the Superstorm Sandy, bigger than had been anticipated, and a pretty big challenge to the infrastructure of Connecticut. And I know that, once again, at a multi-department level, you ultimately, you know, crafted a state response to the challenges of bigger storms, the bigger storms we'll be having because of climate change. But I don't know, how good a shape do you think the state is in for that kind of thing going forward?
Well, you know, listen, I think it's going to get worse every year, not better, because the water levels are rising, and they're rising rapidly. You know, one of the pieces of legislation we got in this last session was to require new maps be drawn to reflect what happens over the next 50 years. That'll be a big plus for planning purposes, but it also means that a lot of folks are going to realize suddenly that they should lift their house voluntarily and not wait for it to be washed away, or that our government shouldn't allow things to be replaced or built in certain neighborhoods. That may even have a lasting impact on the tax base of some of these communities. All of that needs to be filtered in and taken into consideration if we're going to keep people safe and if we're going to recover from other challenges. Now, you know, we went through Irene, and this is one of the interesting historic facts about it. We got really badly beaten up by Irene. The reality is that the damage done by Irene and Sandy in Connecticut weren't very far apart. They were basically equal. New York City and New York didn't get impacted by Irene to any great extent. As a result of that, in the October snowstorm that year, by the time Sandy came around, you know, we drilled pretty deeply on being ready for the next big challenge, and that it came so quickly meant that we were, I think, more inclined to take it seriously and better responders to those efforts. So we evacuated places that didn't get evacuated by other states. We communicated differently, and I would argue more effectively than other states did about the actual harm. And when I got called back to the EOC after a one-hour rise in the water level in southwestern Connecticut, down a portion of the state where I'm from, Fairfield County. We saw a rise faster than we had ever experienced in history of record keeping. I came back to the operation. We calculated what a reasonable time to continue to advise people to leave their premises. And then we said, shelter in where you are. Do not move. Do not get on the road. Do not drive your car. Your best shot of survival is sheltering in place. That was after a relatively short window of saying, get the hell out of there. Mm-hmm. And I think the get the heck out of there and shelter in place was saved a number of lives on that late evening. And you learn from, all experiences. And hopefully, when there's these gaps in those kinds of things happening, hopefully no one will lose the overall lessons that we learned in Irene and the October snowstorm and Sandy and all the other storms that we were impacted by. I also say that, since we elected Nancy Wyman lieutenant governor, we've had 7 of these things, and I blame it all on her.
All right, exactly. It's the way that I always, whenever you guys are at the EOC and you're there in your fleece and you're talking, I always look over at Nancy Wyman, and her game face tells me basically like how much trouble we're really in here.
Yeah.
So you're actually moving down there. After all this, you're moving down to the shore.
Well, we're moving to Essex, and we're going to live down that way. Not on the water, but we're going to live. I wish I could afford to live on the water. I'd probably raise the house, but I wish I could do it, but I can't.
And I don't know, just very quickly, and then we're going to take a break. I mean, how are you picturing, the first year of your life? You talked about your partnership and best friendship with your wife, but she's probably at a certain point. Going to say, look, get out of the house. You're bothering me.
Well, listen, I don't. I am looking for the next big challenge. I'm finally grown up, and I need a real job. So, so I'm looking for that. And I bought myself some time. I was recruited by a couple of colleges to teach, and got a very big fellowship. And at my alma mater, Boston College Law School, where. That's an institution, not just the law school, but the undergraduate program that I owe a lot to. And the idea that I can go back and teach a couple of days a week and extend the period of time for me to make a decision about what I'm going to do next is a nice circumstance for me. But I'm looking for another big challenge.
All right. So if anybody has a big challenge, we're not live right now, so you can't call in with it, but you can email it to me. All right. So we'll take a little break. We have one more segment here with Governor Daniel Malloy.
Miss the Saturday dance. Heard they crowded the floor. Couldn't bear it without you. Don't get around much anymore.
We are back. This is our third and final segment of a conversation, the last conversation I will probably have with Governor Daniel Malloy while he's governor. Before I ask you another question, I'm going to play another clip. This is your 2016 JFK Library Profile in Courage Awards Ceremony speech.
We have rejected the rhetoric of those who would have us bar our neighbors from our nation. I'm not saying that one or two people running for president may not mention it from time to time, but overall Americans are returning to the right idea that we should honor our history, who we are, and what we have said and done in the past. There will be other occasions when we'll be called upon to do this, whether it's standing up for transgender individuals in the face of religious freedom laws that are nothing more than legal permission to discriminate. There will be other challenges to those basic freedoms that we hold dear, but let there be no doubt that there will be other Americans who will stand up and say, not in my land, not in my country, not in my city, not in my state.
All right, so that was May 1st, 2016. I think it's probably fair to say that as you gave your approximation of the way things were in America, you were a little bit optimistic.
Yeah, well, listen, I did not think that Donald Trump, I was not thinking on May 1st, 2016, that Donald Trump was going to be a president and institutionalize discrimination.
And not only that, but his vice president would be Mike Pence, a guy that you have sparred with over issues of LGBTQ rights too, right?
And yeah, refugees and yes, and you know, again, these are folks who will use religion as a basis to discriminate, which is kind of abhorrent if you think about it.
Well, I mean, I don't know. I how are you feeling right now? I mean, this is a very nervous time. You and I are talking. It's actually December 27th when we're talking. Where it'll be January by the time people hear this. But it's been a terrifying December. There have been lots of other scary months here. We've got a government shutdown right now. We've got a stock market that has mostly been in free fall. We've got a Secretary of Defense, often regarded as one of the last adults in the room, who resigned using Department of Defense letterhead to say he couldn't support the president's policies anymore. How do you feel about the shape America's in? There's a little bit of, there are little glimmers of hope in that 2016 speech. Do you still have that hope?
Well, I mean, there's glimmers of hope in the last election as well, and quite frankly, in the municipal elections in Connecticut the year before. There are glimmers of hope. I it is a more desperate situation because you have the president of the United States dehumanizing the American population. I you know, this thing about refugees, you know, we've been signatories since 1951 to a treaty that requires us to accept our share of refugees. And that was an outgrowth of the failure to properly redistribute refugees after the Second World War. We have individual agreements with nations to do that. We have a president who will abrogate all responsibilities and treaties as if they mean nothing. And you know what that means? They will soon mean nothing, which means that we as a country will not be able to rely on agreements that we have with other states because they are coming to understand that they can't rely on us. That is the dangerous proposition.
There are fewer and fewer refugees coming into Connecticut now because there are just fewer and fewer refugees coming into the United States. You won that award because of your handling of Syrian refugees. Although a couple of years before that, there were refugees from the so-called Northern Triangle of Central America. There was a proposal to relocate them temporarily, kids at the old Southbury Training School. And you said no that time. What was the difference between those two times?
Because you were going to put kids in jail. Mm. That's why. That was a proposal, a misguided proposal, that the Trump administration has now done. Mm-hmm. We take kids and we put them in jails. We call them tent cities. We call them educational institutions. That's all BS. They're prisons. We're putting children in prison, and I would not do that, period. By the way, yeah. We said we'll take our share of kids. They'll be properly placed with families, with foster care, but we would not open it. We closed that institution because it was the wrong way to house people. And now people are saying, well, let's open it up again and we'll just put refugees in there whose crime as a child is that their parent brought them to the border. It made no sense. It was ill-conceived, so ill-conceived that they dropped it once they understood that there were people like me who rejected it.
What's your relationship with Ned Lamont like these days? I know you've sort of left a blueprint or a set of hopes, things that you policies you hope will be continued, challenges that you think need to be faced. I don't know. Are you communicating directly with Ned Lamont these days?
We have communicated directly. We've communicated indirectly. You know, I made a pledge to myself 8 years ago that whoever was going to follow me, I was going to Republican or Democrat, we were going to treat them better than we had been treated coming in. That there'd be a freer flow of information, that we'd be prepared to share that information, that there would be more courtesies extended. I was prepared to do that if a Republican had won, and certainly prepared to do it with respect to a Democrat. Happened to be happier that it's a Democrat, I'll be honest, but I was prepared to do that, and so were our commissioners. So I think there's been free flow of information. We've shared a lot of information. One of the reasons we worked on this document that reports what we did accomplish, what we failed to accomplish, and what someone else might want to try to accomplish was as part of that effort as well.
What do you think happened in 2018 here in the state of Connecticut? The gubernatorial race was relatively close compared to this incredible surge in legislative races. And obviously in the Senate, you've got Scott France losing a Republican seat in Greenwich that Republicans never lose. You've got Tony Boucher losing a state in the seat in the New Canaan Ridgefield area that Republicans typically would hold. Ultimately, there was a big sweep of these seats that looked safe. The Danbury seat, McLaughlin, lost to Kushner. Well, do you think it was just just one thing, a bunch of things? What was going on?
I think there were a lot of things going on. And I've said this, I don't think it's been reported as much, but I knew the next morning after the year before election, when Democrats swept into a very large number of communities as mayors and selectmen or majorities on the boards, I knew that day that we could elect a Democrat as governor. We just had to find the right Democrat, or the right Democrat had to find us, but we could elect a Democrat. And I never lost faith in that. It may not be as big as some wins, but, you know, I won my first race by 6,400 votes. So it was a landslide. Having said that, there were lots. I mean, the Republicans deployed probably the dumbest campaign they possibly could have deployed. They let's run against a guy who's already said he's leaving.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I mean, that's what they did. And let's not distance ourselves from the president because we may offend some of our base. Well, they should have been distancing themselves as opposed to embracing Trump politics, and they should have come up with something to say other than, you know, we don't like Dan Malloy, who's already told you he's leaving. It was just a stupid campaign that they ran, and they got spanked for it. It's probably a good thing that they got spanked for it, because they should have distanced themselves from Trump from day one. We have a woman who wanted to be the speaker who had embraced Trump. We had Senator Fasano who couldn't find a way to distance himself sufficiently for fear of his own caucus, resenting it. I mean, it's just it. They had no idea what they were doing, and whoever they got from out of the state to tell them what to do, they should get their money back.
I think there's another issue that people don't talk about. I'm like the only person who talks about this, but I think you're going to – well, you might tell me I'm wrong. I think guns are still a big issue in Connecticut. I mean, we live in a time where parents are scared every day when they send their kids off to school. We live in a time – you and I didn't go through lockdown drills when we were in elementary school. But for kids today, that kind of stuff is a reality. A lot of the candidates that I just mentioned ran with more gun laws as an issue. Gun storage, I think, is going to be a big fight in the legislature this year. I think that's one of the really undercounted issues.
I think that's absolutely true, and that's one of the spaces that they wouldn't distance themselves from with the president and the NRA. I mean, why the NRA has any influence in Connecticut is beyond me. And not to understand that women were going to play the major role in deciding this election. I'll tell you another crazy thing that came out. You know, the no vaccine. In the last 2 weeks of the campaign. So, there are people who are anti-vaccine. I understand that. Most people have their children vaccinated. So we have a candidate who comes out against vaccination, by the way, following by just a couple of weeks, a major outbreak in a disease that people can get a vaccination for. You can't make this stuff up.
One of the things that has been brought forward towards the end of your time has been, I always forget the name of the Fiscal Stability Commission. I always call it the Doomsday Commission, but the Patricelli and Smith Commission. They've got a whole bunch of recommendations. Everybody always says they can cut $1 billion out of the state budget. Stefanowski said the same thing. They say the same thing. There's $1 billion in there that's waste and fraud and fat. I think you and I both agree if there were $1 billion that could be cut, somebody would have cut it by now. Did any of their recommendations intrigue you?
Well, actually, I'm going to say a couple of things. Number one, the people who learned the most from that commission were the commissioners, because they went in with the assumption that they knew everything, and they found out fairly quickly that they didn't know everything, and they learned a lot. I think they also, some limited begrudging respect for what my administration had already accomplished was woven into that report, including saying, well, maybe we went too far, at least in one area with respect to the state employee renegotiations. There were a lot of good things in there. I think they didn't take advice. They came to see me and said, well, we're going to push for – acceptance of this report, you know, and I said, well, what you really should push for is you know, receiving the report and accepting it as a document, not necessarily getting the legislature to say that they're going to do everything.
They said you couldn't pass just one part of the report.
Right,
everything was integrated and connected, so it all had to pass as a thing.
So that was the second thing they learned, is that you know, reaching too far might have hurt their efforts. Having said that, there's plenty of good work in there. It's not a perfect document, and all of the things that they're recommending may not be obtainable. But I'll go back to what needs to be done, and that is we have to find a solution to the teachers' pension issue along the lines of what we did with the we can't sit here as a state and sell ourselves as a place to live and have employment if we're telling people that their contribution on a yearly basis to a pension system in a $20 billion budget may be as high as $6.5 billion, could easily get to $4.5 billion. That's not how you breed security.
The thing that intrigued me the most about their report on a very geeky level was in the area that they called exemptions. So I assume we're going to define exemptions as instances in which an entity or person would be paying taxes, but for whatever reason isn't paying taxes. They say OFA or somebody estimates the total amount of that to be somewhere around $5 billion. I think they were looking to cut some portion of that. I mean, some of that's you, right? Some of that's economic development through exemption.
Yes and no. I mean, I don't think we created a whole lot of new exemptions, to tell you the truth. And I think we did, in fact, eliminate some of them. One of which we eliminated and gave into, you know, the over-the-counter drug exemption that we did away with for a year. And then people in the legislature wanted to put it back in. And I gave in. I probably shouldn't have. And we put the exemption back in.
I mean, it's a problem, right? It's a problem that you have tax liability.
It's a problem. I think a broader-based system would be a smarter thing to do, and most people wouldn't recognize it. On the other hand, you'll all of a sudden start to get into some really tricky things, architectural fees or design fees or legal bills, and all of a sudden when you're a corporate headquarters center. You know, when I got elected governor, we had 11 Fortune 500 companies. The day I leave, we'll have 17 headquarters for Fortune 500 companies in the state. They buy a lot of services within the state. If you suddenly make everything the corporations buy taxable, if you do that suddenly, I accepted a proposal by the legislature to do a portion of that. That was a mistake. The way it was decided was a mistake. And so the pendulum can swing ever so far in one direction and ever so far in the other. And the key to this thing is getting it right in the middle.
So last question. I live not too far from you. I often am driving by and there you are out running with your state police security. I know you've got something going on with your foot right now, so you're not running. But at some point, you're going to be out there running all by yourself. Is that going to be a good thing or a bad thing?
That's a good thing. Yeah. I'm looking for some alone time, which I haven't had for a long time. And one of the things I miss is, you know, driving in the car and by myself and having some down alone time or listening to a good book being read while I'm, you know, driving some number of miles. There are things that you miss. It's a great job, and it's a great way to live for a period of time. But I think more time just being alone will be very nice for me and for my wife.
Is there any possibility that the book you're listening to will be for purely entertainment, or are these going to be history and policy books?
Well, no, history and they'll mostly be history books or the like. I mean, believe it or not, people enjoy that stuff. You know, there are people who are reenactors of Revolutionary War battles.
They do Broadway musicals about it.
The whole thing. So, I read for enjoyment, but if given a good historical book, I probably would choose that first.
All right. Daniel Malloy, 88th governor of Connecticut, and 88th governor of Connecticut for a few more days. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
All right. I'll be there.